Okay, I'm here at the Young Vic with David Thacker.
Hello.
Hello. So, basically I want to start talking about the very first production you did at the Young Vic was Othello.
Yes.
Can you can you remember why you decided to start off your directorship here with that play?
Well, it's great to be back at the Young Vic. That's the first thing to say, yeah. Jamie. Very much changed, but I was in a room not unlike this. But I had developed a great passion for directing Shakespeare, and I enjoyed directing Shakespeare very much. And I wanted my first production to be a play by Shakespeare, first of all.
Okay.
I also thought it would be good to direct a play that I'd never directed before, and I'd never had the opportunity to direct Othello, and I'd always thought it was a fantastic play. In fact, it was the play perhaps that turned me on to Shakespeare, or to be more precise, Frank Finlay's performance as Iago in the so-called Laurence Olivier film of Othello made me realise how powerful and accessible and comprehensible Shakespeare was. I studied Othello for A-level, as it happens, and I wasn't really enjoying it very much and didn't understand it very much, as I guess is the case for a lot of young people who are taught it in the way that I was taught it then. And I'm not even sure that it might be better for people now, given that so many people study Shakespeare without reading the whole play, which seems slightly weird to me, but so a friend and I decided to go to see the film, which had been recently released when we were studying it for A-level, and I was completely blown away by Frank Finlay's performance, simply because I just understood everything he said. And so it had been a play that had been around in my consciousness for a while, and I just then thought, well, this is great, a really great opportunity to direct this wonderful play for my opening at the Young Vic. I can't say there were any particular thematic reasons or political reasons or social reasons that made me want to pick that play. It's just a play I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Although, ironically, it turned out, I think, that reviewers thought that there was some major political reason for doing the play, but that's another question which we may come on to.
Yes, well, let's go on to that. Simply because the program and the press release for that both have the tidbit that it was the first time a black actor had been cast in the role of Othello on the London stage for over 20 years.
Yes, since Paul Robeson.
Yeah, well, Errol John at the Old Vic in 60-something.
Yeah. Yes.
So there was but do you remember what was guiding that?
Well, yes. First of all, it wasn't... I didn't decide... Let's make one thing absolutely clear. Yeah. I didn't decide to do the play so that we could say this is the first time a black actor has played this role for God knows how many years. No, it kind of came around a different way than that. But that I had no idea that was the fact until I started casting the play. No, just to repeat, I did the play because I think it's a fantastic play, a very difficult play. Then I just set about casting it.
Right.
I think in relation to your question, I think it's quite important that discussions of Othello don't get hijacked into the question of a black actor or not a black actor. Mm. That seems to me to be a no-brainer anyway, but that's something we by all means we could discuss, but it seems to me way beyond the need to discuss it now. Mm. As an issue. But for me, the thing that I think is probably more important to talk about is what an incredibly difficult role Othello is to play. And prior to directing Othello, I'd directed Hamlet, I directed Macbeth, I directed Romeo and Juliet, I directed Measure for Measure.
Where was this at the?
But the first professional production I ever directed was Macbeth at York Theatre Royal. At the Duke's Playhouse Lancaster, I directed Measure for Measure and Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet. I directed a small-scale touring production of Julius Caesar, and as a student, I directed The Winter's Tale. Of course, you can't really count those in terms of some kind of CV, but in terms of my experience and knowledge of Shakespeare, and also Pericles, which is a play that I revisited years later. But now, at the time, I felt, and I can say this with a little bit more authority now, because I've directed many, many other plays by Shakespeare since then, I believe at the time, and I would still say, that Othello was probably the hardest role, or is the hardest role, that I've encountered for an actor to have to play. Mm. Partly because it's textually complex, though not as complex as, shall we say, The Winter's Tale or Coriolanus. I mean, probably in the plays that I've directed, probably Coriolanus, some of the speeches in that, and in The Winter's Tale, some of the speeches in that are exceptionally complex syntactically, just in terms of grasping the literal meaning of those plays. The speeches, and more important than grasping it, putting across the literal meaning so that the audience understand what on earth is going on in some of those long and difficult speeches. Now, not as difficult as that, but certainly full of metaphor, lyrically very impressive and thrilling. But the reason it's so difficult, I think, is that with those other parts, you get a kind of let up. If you're playing Hamlet, you get off for quite a lot of the play. And also, I'm not sure that Hamlet is emotionally draining in the same way. That Othello, the actor playing Othello, keeps having to go from massively emotional scene to another massively emotional scene, all very profound and exhausting, I think, and requiring a depth of emotional engagement that in some of those other great plays you may have to do in one or two scenes here or there, but this is non-stop, one after another, after another, after another, after another. And also, I think, just the technical facility to be on top of all that, and have the skill, the technique, the range, and the emotional capacity to do that, I think is exceptionally demanding. Mm. So whoever you get to play it, it's going to be tough. And it's going to be tough for any actor playing it, and it's also going to be tough, frankly, to find an actor good enough to play it to the kind of, if you're going for the kind of World Cup final standard of performance, then it's going to be hard to find people who are going to pull that off. So, having said all that, then, you then, I suppose, someone could say, well, if that's the case, why give yourself the added difficulty of having to limit your choice and decide only to cast an actor who is either Afro-Caribbean or African or perhaps Asian. I think anyway, black or brown in some way, why give herself that headache? We can discuss that if you want to. To me, it's a kind of open. Given that the actors from ethnic minority groups have so little opportunities, so few opportunities to play any great roles in wonderful plays, there's so many limitations put on what they are cast in, and indeed still people are very, very reluctant. We'll find all kinds of reasons for not casting black actors in Chekhov or Ibsen or Tennessee Williams or whatever, you know, Arthur Miller, that people will rationalise why this part isn't suitable for a black actor, or it would distort the meaning of the play. Although those kind of rationalisations still go on. And so if that's going to be the case, and you take away from black actors one of the greatest roles ever written, I mean, and it seems to me to be politically completely unacceptable. Plus, of course, it's frankly stupid. You know, it just looks completely stupid. What are you going to do? Have someone putting on makeup? Or what are you going to do? I mean, it's just ridiculous, I think.
Yeah.
Those people who wish to argue the other case, as there are people who do, I have to say it's not a discussion that I would find very fruitful, to be honest.
No. But let's go back to casting Othello.
Yes.
The one you actually did.
Yeah.
It was obviously Rudolph Walker. So
who I'd never heard of. This might seem odd as well now, with the benefit of all these years, 31 years ago, I met every single black actor while I was casting that role.
Yeah.
And the difficulty, frankly, was at the time that there would have been very few black actors who would have played the part to my satisfaction. Because for one thing, they didn't have the opportunities to play those kind of parts. So to come in and your very first crack at playing Shakespeare, which Lenny Henry, you know, that was his first crack, wasn't it? Playing Shakespeare,
was.
You know,
yeah.
and did, you know, an exceptionally good job given that. But I think he'd also revealed, with no disrespect to his performance, but also revealed actually that it is probably too big an ask to play that role if you've never done Shakespeare before, because there's just too much you're having to learn too quickly
I think that goes for any leading role in Shakespeare, for anybody. It doesn't matter who, you can't really, almost never have I seen it work, where there's been someone who's had no classical experience, or very little, just getting into a lead.
Well, I would say of Trevor Eve, who played Leontes in The Winter's Tale here, who had, I don't think he'd ever done Shakespeare professionally before, I may be wrong about that, but he was completely fantastic. And I'd never directed him in theatre before when we did that, but I directed him for the BBC in A Doll's House. Doing that, I realised what a wonderful actor he was, and I still believe, having directed him in television things, in Waking the Dead, that he's a phenomenal actor. Anyway, but in general, I take your point, and I agree with it. But so I was therefore facing this situation that I decided to do the play. There was no question that I certainly wasn't going to cast a white actor in the role, and so really it was, in one sense,
Do you remember why that was in 1984? Why you decided that?
Well, for the same reasons that I say now. I don't think my position has changed changed, really, that it's just become more obvious now. But that's what I believed at the time. I felt it would be, well, insulting to all black actors, and politically completely unacceptable, and artistically stupid. Ridiculous, actually. Worthy of ridicule to cast a not black actor or an Asian. I mean, there's a case for believing that Shakespeare was imagining a dusky,
yeah,
and not necessarily negroid features.
Which is obviously what the RSC decided to do 3 years later in 85 by casting Ben Kingsley.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, I digress.
Well, and so then, in one sense, therefore, it's straightforward. You meet every black actor you can get to meet.
Mm.
And then you cast the best one,
right.
Really. And it was, without question, Rudolph was the best actor that I met to play that part. Now, and I think Rudolph brought fantastic skills.
Mm.
And first of all, the thing that moved me most deeply about... Well, there are two things that moved me most deeply about his performance. One was his rich, sonorous voice, and the West Indian timbre, and his depth of his voice, and I just found very, very moving and compelling when he would say speeches like "Rude am I of speech" and whatever, that you sort of, you believed all this, and also you believed that the man would speak with the natural lyricism and an exotic turn of phrase, if you like, that it's sat very, very well with Rudolph. Secondly, he had great emotional depth. I mean, he killed himself every night on there, really, kind of. And the reasons will now start coming into my mind, what's good about it. And also, he is, as an actor, and was in that role, particularly likeable and engaging. You could completely understand why Desdemona had fallen in love with him. You could understand why he would be so attractive, and also you could understand why, to a racist father, he would be so repellent. He was very sympathetic to the audience, I would say. And also, the way that we chose to do the play, which was a modern dress production, so he was wearing some of the time kind of khaki uniform sort of stuff, and some of the time, sometimes dinner jackets, sometimes military uniforms or whatever. He was very believable as that kind of soldier.
Mm.
And then also, my great good fortune also, doing the role, doing the play, was that I'd able to persuade David Calder, who had been an actor that I'd admired a great deal, and you may remember, I've mentioned this to you before, but David Calder was very influential in my developing interest in Arthur Miller's work, because yeah. The very first time I saw a play by Arthur Miller was A View from the Bridge at York Theatre Royal.
And I found the programme the other day.
Did you?
In the theatre museum.
And
yeah.
It was directed by Bob Carlton, and was a co-production between the York Theatre Royal and the Duke's Playhouse Lancaster. I saw it at York Theatre Royal, and David was playing Eddie Carbone and was phenomenal, and I'd never seen that kind of acting before, really.
Yeah.
And he and Rudolph made a wonderful combination. They got on very well as men, and they played off each other very well, and they complemented each other exceptionally well. So
do you remember what the take on the relationship between the two of them was?
Well,
the two characters.
Yes, well, first of all, I think the thing that Dave and I believed quite quickly, and I guess if I was directing the play again, this would still be my starting point now, was that Othello is a psychopath. Iago is a psychopath, and that basically, probably if I directed the play again, I'd do a little bit more research about the nature of being a psychopath. But with the kind of colour sup knowledge I've had since, as it happens, through directing Waking the Dead on television, in which two of the episodes that I directed involved characters who were psychopaths, and I got to research that a little bit more, and it seems to me that Iago betrays all those characteristics. And so when A.C. Bradley talks about it as motiveless malignity, I think that's sort of on the money, really. That it, but to me, it would be then, if now the terrible example for me would be Huntley, the man who killed the two little girls, Jessica and Holly, the little girls wearing their Manchester United shirts, yeah. And he was a school caretaker, and he was on television a great deal, you know, speaking to camera, utterly plausibly, looking as if he was so concerned, and perhaps the police were onto him very early on, because as is so often the case with these horrific murders, it's the last person who sees them who turns out to be the person who's murdered them. But anyway, now this of course is years after our production, but basically the thing that David and I were very clear about was that if everybody keeps saying over and over and over again, Honest Iago, and even down to Desdemona believing, oh, this is the man who's going to help me. So often when I've seen the play, you never believe, within 5 minutes, you don't understand how anyone can think he's honest. It's self-evidently got some psychological flaw of some kind. And I don't just mean in the soliloquies. I suppose you could justify it. Well, the audience see that in this, perhaps, but I think the key to the soliloquies, as you know, always when I'm directing Shakespeare, it's for the character to pretend that, or the actor stroke character to believe that the audience is like their best friend, so that the person is able to tell the audience through a soliloquy stuff that they would never tell anyone else, and so they completely open up. And so Iago is doing that a lot of the time. But nevertheless, I think we should be... It'd be shocking for us that we are receiving this intimate, like sort of detailed plans from this man, what he's going to do, as still as if it's coming from a very, very plausible person. A person who seems very nice, actually, and attractive. Not someone who seems a complete maniac, but... Anyway, you get what I'm saying,
yeah.
And that worked. I think David was phenomenal in that part. I think it's still probably one of the best performances ever given. I think he was completely and utterly credible in that role, and sort of rather shocking to some London critics, as indeed the whole production. My memory of the reviews of the production was that they were rather surprised by what they saw as this particularly naturalistic way of playing the play. But the speeches are very naturalistic. A lot of the prose speeches, a lot of them,
yeah.
Iago's speeches, I guess, if my memory serves me correctly, that a lot of them will be prose direct address to the audience, aren't they?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I'd have to check it out, right?
I said
someone will say no, they're not there. They're all first. but anyway, whatever they feel to me like very, very, very like the language of real speech.
Yeah.
Let's put it like that.
Yeah.
And also, Jamie, it wasn't any great attempt on my part to. To suddenly reinvent the way you do Shakespeare. It's just that's the way I'd always sort of done it in the previous productions,
yeah.
And still do it like that. I mean, that's kind of what I think. But that isn't clearly to everyone's taste.
No.
And what I've come to realise about Shakespeare more than anything else is that people have such strong feelings about how they think you should do it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was also lucky to assemble an exceptionally good cast around them as well. We had Brian Prothero, who played Cassio, one of, I think, the best drunken performances.
He's got a very good cameo as a drunk in the current Othello.
Oh, has he?
Yes.
Oh, he's doing a cameo, is he?
Well, he's playing Brabantio, but he has to come back on as a local drunk in the party scene.
Yeah.
He does drunk extremely well.
Yeah, he's a big drinker.
Clearly, it's a.
And it's been lovely to work with Brian all these years later again. Mm. And Kate Fahey is Desdemona, who was lovely. So that was my thinking at the time.
Okay. So the when. Going back to the sort of program and the press release and things, when did that kind of develop as a selling point?
When we realised it was the case.
Yeah.
That I suppose for publicity reasons, you do grab anything, don't you?
Yeah.
Really,
you
anything.
Do.
And I think that, and sometimes you make it look as if that was the intention, but actually it's just something you think has got newsworthiness.
Yeah.
So. Once we realised that, to my great surprise, that it had been so long since it had been performed by a non-white actor, we tried to make the best of it, really.
Do you think there was any impact of a London theatre, such as the Young Vic, you know, on the fringe, quote-unquote, doing that? Do you think there's any impact to the rest of the theatre world in thinking?
Well,
I mean,
are people writing? Is someone writing a history of the Young Vic? I'd be interested if anyone is, because you see, it's hard. Like David Lann has done such a fantastic job of redefining for about the fourth time,
yeah,
what the Young Vic is.
Yes,
and you have to bear in mind when I took it over from Frank Dunlop, mm-hmm. who was the founder artistic director, as you know.
Yeah.
And it was, we all owe it to Frank Dunlop, thank you, because it was his great idea with Laurence Olivier to create this theatre, the purpose of which at the time was to allow young actors in the National Theatre Company, the Old Vic Company, young actors to try out playing bigger parts that they wouldn't get to play at the Old Vic. I mean, I think it's a crazy idea, but that's, nevertheless, that was, in a sense, the purpose.
Yeah.
I only mean crazy now. At the time, probably there were extremely good reasons for it. And the kind of style, the most famous production he ever did here was Scapino, and the sort of style of the work that people were used to here, which was clearly very very effective and very popular, was very different to what I was going to be doing. But no one had heard of me, and no one knew I wasn't anybody.
No,
you know, I was
yeah.
just a young, they thought of me as this young man from the north of England who was coming down. And so I don't really think the London theatre, as it were, were very interested in it, to be honest, other than anyone who was interested in the work of the Young Vic would wait to see what it was like with this new director. I have no way of judging. You'd know better than I would, actually, from looking in the archives, what press coverage there was about how people received. I think the things that my memory of the production, the way it was received by critics and other commentators, was that it focused pretty much on two things. One was the programme note,
yeah.
And I learned a lot about programme notes after that.
Yeah.
And the second was the kind, if you like, the playing style.
Yes.
If my memory serves me correctly.
Yeah, I think that's broadly true. And they either liked it or they loathed it. I don't think there was a middle ground for the most part.
Yes.
But as the years developed, in the mid 80s,
yes,
the And I mean, I think particularly it started with enemies within, but the young Vic under you was developing a reputation, I think, for political theater.
Yes, I think that, first of all, I think there were some false assumptions. Like, for example, David Calder, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying this. There was no reason why he'd mind me saying this. David Calder at the time either was or had recently been a member of the Workers' Revolutionary Party. And the Workers' Revolutionary Party, principally led by Corinne Redgrave and Vanessa Redgrave, mm-hmm. with a lot of very, very significant and distinguished actors, like Malcolm Tierney, for example, Keke Markham. Now, they were very, very active in equity and very intelligent and very articulate and persuasive in equity. I was never a member of the Workers' Revolutionary Party. In fact, when I fell in love with Margot, my wife, who was a member for a time, I used to have very heated arguments with her, discussions with her about the nature of the political perspective. Mm.
Can I just clarify a time frame on that? Was that while you were still at the Duke's Lancaster?
Yes, yeah. That's when I met Margot and fell in love with Margot. But I came down as a young innocent, really, mm-hmm. to London, and David Calder was playing Othello, Iago, and it probably some journalists might have known that he of his political affiliations. And what it's hard to believe now, but you have to understand how strong the blacklist was, for example. I mean, if you read Pete Hall's diaries, for example, some actors were blacklisted by the Royal Shakespeare Company, Corin Redgrave being one, you know, who were just not allowed to work in these companies and the National Theatre because they were members of the Workers' Revolutionary Party. Now, actually, for people like me who were broadly speaking left wing, what they were offering, I think, was a rigorous analysis that was very stimulating and interesting, even though, for me, I never believed it. I never believed the Marxist analysis that they were offering up. But now, having said that, then the second crucial thing was that my very good friend, still good friend, Richard Wilson, who I was at university with, at York University, and is still one of my favourite critics of Shakespeare and writers on Shakespeare, most stimulating and challenging. He had written for me program notes for the Lancaster productions, Measure for Measure, Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet. Now, the program notes he wrote were, if you like, a companion piece to the production. So they were there to stimulate discussion about the production. Yeah. They weren't an articulation of what the production was meant to do.
Right.
Even though we would talk about the plays before he would write the programme note, but he was very keen to preserve his intellectual independence, scholastic independence, and I was equally keen to preserve my directorial independence. And so at the time at Lancaster, if you read some of those programme notes, which I still think are brilliant, the one on Romeo and Juliet, which I recycled.
You recycled it,
yes,
Bolton.
Yes, yeah, and recycled it several times, I think is still a really... And at the time where the big menace at the time, when we did it at Lancaster, first of all, Romeo and Juliet, were the missiles. And so he would very wittily draw a comparison between the fallacies and in the male-dominated society, whatever, and the missiles or whatever, that now innocent, naive David shows up at the Young Vic, and Richard writes the program note, and I thought, oh, that people like this, people will be stimulated by this. And
it was, for the record, called The Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, and also had phrases in it, left on my memory, still there in my head somewhere, saying things like Iago's conquest of Othello is the conquest of imperialism or something. And I think, and Karl Marx is mentioned once or twice, I believe, in the programme note. And I think then the SDP supporting Michael Billington, to name one, and others, I think, looked at this and drew the wrong conclusion, really. They thought, oh, David Thacker is trying to do some Marxist reading of Othello, which was absolutely not true. But I've realised in subsequent years the importance of programme and the fact that programme notes lead reviewers more than anything else, and that actually reviewers, not only that, but they love to be able to nick from the programme notes, they love to be able to,
and the press releases,
yes, and everything, and but at the time I was innocent of all that, so I think there was, I think some of the negative reviews were negative because they thought I was in some way hijacking the play to turn it into a political event. I was very surprised, actually, when I was surprised that they couldn't see past that, and they weren't actually more, let us say, concerned with actually the way the play was unfolding as a theatrical event, because I think it was very dynamic and compelling production, which I was very proud of at the time and still am proud of. But I think that what's true is, of course, I don't think any of us stay in a fixed position. Well, I hope we don't. Well, I think the sad thing about the perhaps contemporary politics is that people do stay locked into it. But let me give an example. I have become of the view now, as we speak, that following the annihilation or the bullying of Greece by the international banks and Angela Merkel in particular, and the complete removal of any democratic legitimacy, now I would now be arguing for the withdrawal of the United Kingdom from the European Union, for example. That will now, my position will now that position has been hijacked by UKIP.
Yeah.
But I think you'll find that more and more and more people are now saying, we don't want anything to do with that Europe. We don't want anything to do with international bankers telling us what to do, not allowing us to pass, running our economy for us, I mean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think, I use that as an example of the way I think, I hope an open-minded person, their politics can evolve and develop. You said that when I was at the Young Vic, it became known to be a bit of a political theatre. Well, I think it did because, for example, if you take Corin Redgrave, I was the first director to actually employ him for years and years and years. Now, that's partly because he'd been so tied up with his political work that he didn't really want to work in theatre very much. But also because people were frightened that he'd be in some way be some disruptive element, whereas Corin was a most wonderful company member, delightful, popular, funny, witty, intelligent company member. And also because I think people would be scared of him because he was a pretty ferocious intellect. But I'd been where I became very committed to Corin as an actor was when I'd been invited to a benefit performance at Liverpool Playhouse in which his family were raising money actually for the Workers' Revolutionary Party, or an adjunct of the Workers' Revolutionary Party, I think. And on stage was Corin Redgrave and Vanessa Redgrave, Rachel Kempston and Sir Michael Redgrave. And Sir Michael Redgrave at this time in his life was in the latter stages of Parkinson's disease. And one of the most moving things I've ever experienced in my life was Sir Michael Redgrave doing the Seven Ages of Man speech, being prompted, and Vanessa was sitting next to him, and he did several extracts, but for this in particular, and every time he dried, she was gently feeding him the line, and the whole issue, you thought, oh, I see, he's going to dry a lot. Of course, he's got Parkinson's disease. So and when he does dry, Vanessa will feed him the line. And his grasp and understanding, intellectually and technically and emotionally, of what that speech is about, you know, sounds everything. Mm. As it ends, was quite remarkable. Anyway, Corin, in the same event, did a number of extracts from Shakespeare, including Hamlet's soliloquy, "Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I," for example. And when I saw that, I thought, God, he's this amazing actor. What an amazing Shakespearean actor. So when I got the chance to offer him work, and the first time I was able to was Danforth in The Crucible. Mm. And then later on, he was Brutus in Julius Caesar here. He was in Measure for Measure, and also played Coriolanus, Jane Howell's production of Coriolanus. And again, so people made an assumption, oh, David Thacker must be in league with this lot, actually, if they're all coming to work at the Young Vic. And also Vanessa was played in Ghosts and also A Touch of the Poet. Now, no, I was actually quite oppositional to their politics from a left perspective, but people made certain kinds of assumptions that I don't think were accurate about the theatre. But on the other hand, of course, if you're doing a play about the miners' strike, in which you actually very clearly that the police, and the role of the police and the role of the media, all of which is now abundantly clear, yeah. You know, and at the time this was seen to be incredibly provocative and wide of the mark, where now as everything in and we did it, as you know, recently, and then at the end, Miss Widwin, I did it at Eddie's Grow Heathrow. But there's a different kind of politics that perhaps we should talk about, which is perhaps relevant to some of the thing you've raised,
yeah,
which is that I did, after Othello, become more and more conscious, perhaps because of the experience of interviewing a number of actors for the role, but not casting them, of the very, the lack of opportunities for black and ethnic minority actors to perform in great plays. Mm. And so my next production, which was Macbeth, had seven black actors in it, and I have to say that was a political decision on my part, which was, right, we've got to give opportunities. And so I went out of my way to be able to cast black actors. Mm. And so that was quite a lot at the time, to have seven actors in a play by Shakespeare was
it still is.
Yes. And then I commissioned a play by David Holman, wonderful, wonderful play for children and family audiences, called Solomon and the Big Cat, which was set in Tanzania, and also was interesting, and it's a play about a young little Tanzanian boy who loved running, who loved running and had to run to school every day, miles and miles and miles. And the device of the play was that his big brother, Isaac, was running in the Olympics. Can't remember what Olympics it was close to at the time. And he was running the marathon. And two things came together wonderfully when the little boy had to run to save the lives of these leopards who'd been got by poachers. And the spirit of his brother came, who was simultaneously running and supporting him and motivating him and helping him to run to get to save the life of this little baby leopard. Anyway, that production, no thanks to me, but David had got hold of Bill Mitchell, and he'd written this play that required puppets actors being puppeteers and whatever. I thought, well, this is all very, oh God, this is interesting. And with this brilliant design, we did fantastic work with actors playing birds, way ahead of Warhorse or any of that, actually.
Yeah.
But the relevant point about why I'm raising it is we commissioned a play that needed six black actors. So the entire cast was six black actors. So I think to some extent we did have a positive influence. I don't want to overstate it, but some kind of positive influence on the development of work opportunities for black actors. But as you know, because we've discussed it before, famously for me, not famously in the public domain, but when I was offered the chance to direct Pericles at the RSC,
yeah.
I was absolutely determined to cast Rudolf Walker as Gower, because I knew that he would be fantastic for all kinds of reasons. That he would first of all be a wonderful contact figure, would be a beautiful, beautiful contact figure for the audience, but also would actually make the speech, Gower's wonderfully, well, there's enormous variety in the speeches, you know, from the perhaps non-Shakespearean Gower speeches to the ones that are clearly Shakespearean. And there was huge resistance to that at the RSC. And
to casting Rudolf Walker himself? Or?
Yes, right. Yes. Well, to have a black actor playing a Welsh poet.
Okay.
There was a lot of resistance to that.
Right.
And one of the things at the time, I'm not sure what it's like now, but at the time, the way to get an actor in a company was to be able to form alliances with other directors, which I managed to do very successfully with Matt Stafford Clarke later. And also Sam Mendes.
Mm-hmm. And Fleur de Lloyd
so that if you could find a line of three parts for an actor, then they'd get into the company.
Yeah.
So if I want, let's say someone like Finbar Lynch, Barry Lynch he was called at the time, it became Finbar, or Hugh Bonneville.
Richard.
Yes, Richard Barber, yes. I could have them if someone else wanted them. Now, I benefited enormously from Sam Mendes, because he introduced actors to me that I didn't know, mm-hmm. that he wanted in his play, that I was then able to have in the two gentlemen of Verona, much to my delight, because when I look back on that cast, it's an extraordinary cast of young actors. All unknown at the time, but when you look who they all are now.
Yeah.
I couldn't get any other director in that season to cast Rudolf for whatever reasons. Now the reasons, there may have been genuine reasons that they didn't think it was right for a part, But there were definitely old arguments being put. You can't have... Oh, sorry, I'd love to, but my play wouldn't work in my play having a black actor in those roles. I mean, all those things that are trotted out. Oh, yes, but it wouldn't quite work having a black actor in those roles.
And just to clarify for the tape,
yeah.
In the intervening time between 84's Othello and the 89 Pericles, you'd worked with Rudolph Walker at least one more time at the Young Vic as well.
He played Friar Lawrence.
Yeah.
And again, was fantastic in Friar Lawrence, as Friar Lawrence. And I've had a number of Friar Lawrences, and he would be my absolute favourite for the same reasons. He was so warm and generous and passionate, and you really believed he loved those young people. And I mean, I think he was a wonderful Shakespearean actor.
Mm.
But people at the time, people didn't like the West Indian tone of voice, mm. The accent, to put it crudely. And of course, but now, what I'm not going to name names because it wouldn't be true fair to do it. But what I will say, my fellow directors at the time may wish to argue their own case, but my very, very strong memory, certain memory, was that nobody wanted to have Rudolph in one of their plays for a variety of reasons. It may have been they didn't think he was a good enough actor, it may have been that they didn't think there was a part suitable, or it may have meant that they didn't believe that their particular play could be done with a black actor in it. Now, that's the argument that is still raised over and over and over. It must drive black actors insane.
I believe it does, yes.
To hear that argument still being posited.
Yeah.
Now, anyway, he was hugely successful in Pericles. Just to finish this story.
Yeah.
So finally, the way I got round this was to say to Terry Hands, who, by the way, I have a huge regard for, and I'm extremely grateful to him for allowing me to direct the play at all. He invited me to direct Pericles, and that would be particularly hard for him to do, in the sense that Pericles was then, maybe still be, one of his favourite plays, if not his favourite, given that he directed himself a very significant production of the play, I think 10 years before mine, I think, because the play tended to come around about every 10 years. And it's a play that he loved. And throughout the whole process, he was completely supportive of me in the best possible way as an artistic director. But eventually I had to say to Terry, look, Terry, you've got Charles Dance playing Coriolanus, and he's only in Coriolanus, he's not doing anything else. So I can have Rudolph Walker just doing Gower in Pericles, and he doesn't have to be in anything else. That's right, isn't it? Because what's right for you is right for me. And he said, to give him credit, he said, well, yes, if he wants to, but he probably won't want to just do that, will he? Just come and do Gower? And I said, I think you'll find he will, because he'd love the opportunity of working at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and he likes working with me, and I think he'd think it was a great honour to be able to do that. Anyway, I phoned Rudolph and said, I'm going to be completely straight with you, Rudolph. You're going to get an offer that's just to be in one play, and that's because there isn't a part that anyone else wants you to play in their role. I didn't go into what I'm saying now.
Yeah.
Self-evidently, it would have been disloyal and inappropriate. I said, so I'm afraid it's just going to be to do Gower. And he said, well, I'd love to do it. Let me read it first. And I said, of course, read. And he said, that's fine. It means I better do television as well. And looking back on it, it's money for old rope, I tell you. Being in...
Yes, it is.
Doing two performances a week or something.
Yes.
Come up and enjoy. That's why people love acting at the National Theatre, because you only have to do it a few times a week. In comparison with what it's like killing yourself doing 8 shows at Stratford... And when you're playing at night, rehearsing another one, and then, of course, it's delightful, but there are a lot of advantages in just doing the one and going off and keeping your television career going, which is what he did. What he did.
Yeah.
But shall we continue this cycle? Because I think it's important, because you recall with the Two Gentlemen of Verona, Josette Buschelmingo first played Lucetta and then took over as Sylvia.
Yes.
And her father was a white actor, and played by a white actor, and the Times Review, which is worth accessing, gave the same I don't think it used the term political correctness, because I don't think it was around in vogue at the time, but it's basically how insane this is, you know, to have a black actor with a white person. And
but it was okay when she was playing the maid for them.
Oh yes. Well, because you could have black maids. Yes, yeah. I think, to be fair to them, not that I want to be fair to them, but the limitation of their perspective would still be, but can't have a white dad, you know. And but as you know, subsequently, I've had lots and lots of black actors in roles that, if you were going to use that kind of logic, you wouldn't have. It's like in Romeo and Juliet, you know, what does it mean? Does it mean she's adopted in the Octagon production?
Yeah.
Because we've got Rob Edwards as a dad and Paula Jennings, you couldn't, you know, white, gorgeous, blonde mum, and here we've got this utterly beautiful black young actress. But audiences understand that, you know. And as Karen
was well, okay. Well, we've only really got a few more minutes, so let's Josette Buschelmingo. I mean, just to clarify how she stepped up. I mean, was she understudying Sylvia?
Yes.
Yes. And so that was sort of was that just a no-brainer situation?
Well, yes, really. But I remember she said to me after her first day at the RSC, she came out that Adrian Noble had a big meeting for all the actors and other people. There were about 80 actors there, I think. Okay, said, "You notice I'm the only black actor in this room. It just must have been so, so weird."
She was that season, yeah.
Mm. So, so weird to... He must feel so alienated. Well, of course, obviously, what I'm saying is self-evident, isn't it? What black people are experiencing throughout the entire society, but and this is just a microcosm of it. But I think perhaps to round it off, it is worth saying, of course, that if you look at the BBC Shakespeare Shorts thing that we did, in which the premise was that I selected six actors to work on four Arthur Miller plays, and I decided, because this was going out to schools, and I've always felt it's just awful to think that that kids at school are just seeing everything done by white faces, and decided we were going to have a multicultural group. And so in that group we had Patterson Joseph, for example. And
just playing Rodolfo in View from the Bridge.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And some of the coverage is very witty, very funny, I think, when he's...
We were talking about being blonde,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it was. Yes.
But actually, the minute you make that, you say, yes, okay, he's playing Rodolfo, I think Patterson was a fantastic Rodolfo. It was completely the essence of what Rodolfo...
Because
is.
Rodolfo, in many ways, is the outsider anyway.
Yes.
So a lot of those lines...
Yes.
...in that, even though they were funny, because it was, you know, he's obviously not a blonde...
Yeah.
...that it worked, because he... And, you know, he's an immigrant.
Yes.
So it kind of it.
And one of the things I think is really important that is properly written up before my generation all die off is the role of theatre and education in the development of British theatre. Because, of course, theatre education companies were, certainly around the time I was at the Young Vic, were habitually multicultural companies and were doing play. And so they go into schools, say, and you do play where there are 10 actors. And you even... Did you see Tull, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah, no, so that's I think that's a very good example of how, even with a play in which you'd say, well, surely in that play of all plays, you've got to keep the white people separate from the black people.
Yeah.
Right, so everyone, and you've got Tull, who's clearly black, and his brother is black. And actually, Mark Small, who played his brother, also played a lot of white characters as well. And no confusion of any kind, even without any costumes, without any props, without anything.
Yeah.
Just the actor using their craft to play a variety of other parts. And so I have no zero patience with that view that sort of says, oh, you know, it will damage the play, the credibility of the play if you have...
Yeah.
You've only got to read Arthur Miller and Salesman in Beijing, haven't you? And
yeah.
And the fact that if Death of a Salesman can work with Chinese actors...
Yeah.
And the way he tried makes them get rid of all their wigs and everything, they were, as you know, trying to do it in the rehearsals, and they came with their Western wigs and trying to be like Westerners. And they say, no, just be like Chinese people, do the play like Chinese people. And,
yeah. Yeah, excellent point. I think maybe we'll leave it there with Arthur.
Great. Well, is this? Do you think you've got a range of what you need?
Yeah, I think I've got